I don't know whether this is the drop-off from just the standard drop-off of people are less likely to attend, the drop-off of this isn't covered on the midterm tomorrow, or the drop-off of it looks like Putin wants World War III, and it officially kicked off yesterday. Little column A, little column B, little column C. So, anyway, let's talk about cryptocurrencies. This is, I think, a really good tweet that just the other day that sums it up real well. Algorithms, I want to solve a problem. Data science, I want to understand a problem. AI, I want to solve a problem but not understand the solution. Thus my Rage Against the Machine Learning t-shirt. And blockchain, I want to be a problem. So why talk about this at all? I am a actual bona fide world-renowned expert in this area, I'm sad to say. Because it has been one of my research focuses for the past 9 years. And let's face it, one of the advantages of a place like Berkeley as opposed to, say, your local junior college is you actually can talk to experts in fields who are, well, actually, no, if you want viticulture, Napa Valley is really good. But anyway, you have experts. So this is an area that specifically touches on my expertise. And basically, I've been mining this space for both academic papers and comedy gold since 2013. And no, that's not a typo. Because I want it to die in a fire. Basically, there's no value in this space. None. Zero. Zilch. Zippo. And I'm going to tell you why. Private blockchains are a 20-plus-year-old idea. And we'll see that. Public blockchains are grossly inefficient without actually being decentralized, like criminally inefficient, and only are good for cryptocurrencies. And cryptocurrencies don't work as currency unless you're a criminal. The entire space is a self-assembled Ponzi scheme, but it's refused to go away. But it also touches on a lot of real-world security issues that often have nothing to do with actual security. And so this is a computer security class. Have to cover this. But a disclaimer, this is mostly blue slides. First of all, this can't really be tested on. Second of all, I don't want people to worry about this. This is basically intellectual vaccination. Once you realize how bleeding stupid the space is, how incredibly brain dead stupid it is, you'll be immune from wasting your time on them. And there are some concepts of relevance. So hash chains, Merkle trees, and Sybils are all things I'll talk about during this lecture, and those you should know. The rest, die in a fire. So let's talk about linked lists. Okay, blockchains and cryptocurrencies. So a blockchain technology is a fancy word for an append-only data structure. That is a data structure where you can only add data to it, you can't remove it. It, however, has this miraculous property. It causes people's eyes to glaze over and throw money at you. But when you look at it, it actually splits into two separate camps, the permissioned blockchains and the public blockchains. A permissioned blockchain, you have a limited number of authorized individuals that are responsible for keeping the records. This is something we've known how to build for decades, and we'll show you. The public blockchains, the idea is anybody can participate as appenders and validators, so there's no central authority. The problem is these don't work because of the Sybil problem that we'll get to later. And then the cryptocurrencies themselves don't actually work as currency. They literally don't work as currency. But let's first talk about something useful. Not blockchains, but hash chains. So a hash chain is a 35, 40-year-old idea. The basic idea is a linked list. So we've got some block of data. We compute the hash of it. The hash, as we remember, is effectively a unique identifier for that block. So as long as the hash hasn't changed, you know the block's intact. And each block has a pointer to the hash of the previous block. So if we know that block n is valid and have a hash of block n minus 1, we can then validate that block n minus 1 has not been tampered with. This is a very simple construction. It's basically a linked list. And it's basically, if a data structure includes a hash of the previous block of data, this is a hash chain. It's a linked list. You can keep adding on to it really easily. And so if you have a way of validating the head, because it includes the previous block by reference, and each block includes the previous block by reference, we can validate the whole thing. So the inclusion of the previous block's hash validates that previous block, and because that has a hash, it validates the previous block, and so on. Really cool idea. Really useful idea. Dates back to the 1970s. This also makes it easy to add blocks, that all you need to do is to add block n plus 1, you have its data, and you have the hash of block n. So it makes it very easy to add data on, because although all our data can be represented by the hash of the head of the chain, we don't need to worry about actually hashing that when we add on. So this gives us an efficient append-only data structure. We just add blocks to the head. And if you cryptographically sign the head, voila, that's it. As long as you now have some assurance on the head with cryptographic integrity, that's a hash chain. 30 years ago, people were using this in operation for a cryptographic timestamp service. So the idea is, I have something I want to prove I did at time t. I provide a cryptographic hash to the trusted timestamp service, and it includes it in its block of data, and it says, I signed this at time t. And then when it signs the next block, it refers to the previous one. A certificate revocation list is a signed hash chain. Hash chains are an old, old idea. And anybody who says that Bitcoin came up with hash chains, whack them upside the head, because they're lying to you, or they're so ignorant as to not know basic security. Likewise, a related structure that is often used in cryptocurrencies that people act as a revolution from is a Merkle tree. The idea is I have a large data set that I want to hash, but I want to be able to update elements. So I want to update the element in the middle and update the hash of the whole thing. So the idea is we hash each element, then hash two elements together, then hash those together, and so on, forming a tree. So this allows us a structure where we can update that final hash easily. So to update the final hash, it takes log n work, not O of n work, if we want to change something. So that's a hash tree, also known as a Merkle tree. Really, really revolutionary idea in 1979. So Merkle trees are cool. Merkle trees are great. Merkle trees are a data structure you should understand. Merkle trees are older than everybody in this room but me. The crypto people like to somehow think that Bitcoin invented Merkle trees. And no, it isn't. It's a 40-year-old idea. And using this, let's make a trivial private blockchain construction. We have a single server, S, It's got a public key and a private key. And we have a Git archive, G. So we've taken Git, we fixed it to use SHA-256, so it actually uses a secure hash. And whenever you want to issue a pull request, the server validates the pull request, meets the allowed criteria, checks it into the Git archive, signs the hash of the head. That's it. That is a private blockchain. Can this ever be a business revolution? Git is an append-only data structure. Git is an append-only data structure if you fixed it to use a proper hash, would be cryptographic integrity. Sign the head of a Git archive, you've signed the entire archive. That's all of the private blockchains are in practice. This is why anyone who tells you that private blockchains, permission blockchains, are a revolution doesn't understand the technology. This is something that I could assign as a project here. And the bigger thing is fixing your Gitlet implementation so it actually uses a proper hash function. Anything that would benefit from an append-only limited writer data store already has one. If your problems are solved by an append-only data store, it's in your Git archive already. So what is a cryptocurrency? So the idea is it's a tradable cryptographic token. So the goal is irreversible electronic cash. So Alice wants to pay Bob 200 quatloos for her losing bet on the green thrall and wants to do it electronically where nobody else can block or reverse the transfer. So the idea is let's have a public ledger. So this is what the blockchain really is when people speak of blockchains. For cryptocurrencies is a public ledger. So a public Excel document that says Alice has 3,021 quatloos, Bob has 21, Carol has 1,028. And the idea is people can only add items to the ledger, not remove them. So this Google sheet gets pretty big. And the big idea of the cryptocurrency is Alice writes and cryptographically signs a check saying, I, Alice, pay Bob 200 quatloos. We add that check to the public ledger, and now everybody knows that Alice is down 200 quatloos, and Bob is up 200 quatloos, and that's it. So the idea is we have a public ledger of all the old checks. So Alice writes a check to Bob, says, hey, pay Bob 100 quatloos. Bob takes the check, looks in the public ledger going, oh, Alice, okay, yes, you've got a sufficient balance. Let's get my check added to the public ledger, and now I'm up 200. Alice is down 200, and that's it. The question is how do we structure this public ledger? Now, in a realistic system, this would be easy. You just have a trusted intermediary that keeps this ledger. We've had electronic payments for decades now with the bank doing this, that the bank acts as a gatekeeper on the ledger. The idea behind the cryptocurrencies, though, is let's add a way where anybody could be that gatekeeper. So what happens is everybody involved gathers up the loose checks, copies of the loose checks. For each check, you validate that it's a valid check, that there's payment and everything else. You bundle all the checks up into a block, staple them together with a hash, and a pointer to the previous one. And now, you do a lot of work. And the work is you've added one additional check to the pile that says, pay the miner the reward for the success. The hash of this total stack, including the reward check, is X. And X is just the determinant difficulty factor. That one person gets a hash that's low enough, that meets the requirements, now everybody knows it. Now everybody starts on the previous block. And this is how you get your append-only data. And so we've got our pile of checks. Alice, Bob, and Dave all have their own pay-to-check. They just keep tweaking the pay-to-check until the hash of the resulting stack meets the criteria. When it does, Bob goes, woohoo, I've got a valid stack. And now Alice and Dave basically start all over, pointing to Bob's stack. That's it. And Bitcoin is just the first widely deployed development of the idea. A Bitcoin wallet doesn't hold Bitcoin. It just holds private keys. So we've got our private keys. We've got our public keys. And Bitcoin's blockchain is just its shared ledger. And sending Bitcoin is simply a matter of writing a check and broadcasting it. So pay to Ross Ulbricht Legal Defense Fund the value 0.05 Bitcoin, signed by me. Whoever validates this transaction gets 0.005 Bitcoin. It's signed by this public key. Yes, indeed, that used to be my Bitcoin wallet. I don't have the private key anymore. I basically had a new computer with 16-core processor, and I needed to make sure it was working, so I just generated a gazillion Bitcoin keys until the public key looked the way that is. That's a proof of work, by the way. And you can look it up. This is Bitcoin transaction, D6B24, blah, blah, blah. That's a SHA-256 hash of the transaction. And if you look it up, you actually see this. So you see me paying a piddly small amount of money to the Ross Ulbricht Legal Defense Fund after he was convicted. I believe in justice, but I also believe he's a drug-dealing idiot and his lawyer was a drooling moron. So what is Bitcoin mining? Bitcoin mining is just the particular instance used to protect the transaction history, and it's just SHA-256. Every miner takes all the unconfirmed transactions, puts them into a block currently limited to 1 megabyte of transactions, attaches the pay me the block reward, and attaches the hash of the previous block, and then just does the proof of work calculation. Hash the block, change trivially, hash the block, change trivially, half the block, change trivially, until the hash starts with enough leading zeros. And this is a difficulty factor that automatically adjusts. So worldwide, a new block is validated roughly every 10 minutes. And then the miner that's successful broadcasts the new block. And the block reward right now is 6.25 Bitcoin and is the pay me. So how does the proof of work work? Well, SHA-256 looks random. So if I just tweak one bit, the output looks completely different. So if I present to you a string and a corresponding hash with n zero bits, I probably had to do 2 to the n work. And so you can just, with a single hash, verify that I did a ton of useless work. This is why it's proof of waste. And the idea is to rewrite the last k blocks of history, you have to do as many hashes as were necessary to record those k blocks in the first place. So the goal is basically make it so you can't edit history. Good idea. But there are some issues with this. The first of all is bloat. That in order to verify that Alice has a balance, you have to potentially check every transaction back to the beginning. And so as a result, every full Bitcoin node needs to access the entire transaction history of Bitcoin. And so if you have 10,000 nodes, you've got 10,000 copies of the same data. That's just bloated. There is no way of deleting data. What's the best way to make your data set smaller? Delete stuff. You can't do that in a cryptocurrency. But this also gives a capacity problem. That in order to limit the bloat growth to 1 megabyte a block, as an early defense against spam, there's a limit. Globally, on a worldwide basis, Bitcoin can only process somewhere between 3 to 7 transactions per second. Yes, 3 to 7 transactions per second worldwide. And any Bitcoin taking over money requires centralized things that maintain databases. These are called banks. We've had electronic money for decades now. This also results in price shocks. So when the desired transaction capacity is less than the block capacity, transactions are really cheap. But whenever transaction desired increases above the block capacity, the prices spiral out of control. It's why, like, Ethereum right now to transfer a monkey JPEG is $30, is because the demand to transfer is just slightly more than the capacity. And people have actually done, hey, let's just jam up Bitcoin for the heck of it. Cool. I'm not kidding. That happened. I watched it. I wrote a paper on it. See what I mean? Comedy gold. But there's an even bigger elephant, and that's the power problem. That currently, Bitcoin is consuming roughly the power consumption of Thailand for 3 to 7 transactions per second. Why'd this go out? Basically, this creates what's known as a Red Queen's Race. So the Red Queen's Race was a tale from Alice Through the Looking Glass. The idea is, as long as you have potential for profit, you get an increase in capacity. Efficiency gains get translated into more effort, not less power consumption. Let's suppose I snap my finger right now and make every Bitcoin mining rig on the planet use 1/10 the power. What will happen? We'll just get 10 times the mining rigs. And we'll be back to the same system where we are before, where we're basically burning the power of Thailand and creating a whole bunch of e-waste in the process. Bitcoin's security is proof of wasting power and e-waste. And there's no way to reduce Bitcoin's power consumption without either reducing the price or the block reward. If you care about the environment, and you care about the environment, I hope, because you have to live in it, you should hope that Bitcoin's value goes to zero, and the sooner it does, the better, because this is a measurable, significant amount of the world's global CO2 emissions. 4, 3 to 7 transactions a second. You do see a lot of lies from the Bitcoin folks about power consumption, though. They claim that this rescues stranded power, that you do Bitcoin mining where you can't actually string a wire. But that's why we have a power grid. Unless you're Texas, any electricity source in the US feeds either to the entire East Coast power grid or the entire West Coast power grid. The only way you have stranded power is if you have an electricity generator out in the middle of nowhere where it's too expensive to string a power line, but you can still string a data line. There's this claim that this Bitcoin incentivizes green power. No. Bitcoin mining wants power consumption 24/7, 365. This is what's known as baseload power. Baseload power is hydroelectric, fossil fuel, or nuclear. Can't build many more dams. There's no new spots. So basically, Bitcoin actually gravitates to the dirtiest energy. And in fact, recently, several high pollution, high CO2 power plants have been brought back online for Bitcoin mining in the US. Oh, they go, but other things burn power too. Yeah, like all data centers together probably burn 2 to 3x the power of Bitcoin. That's Google, Facebook, Amazon. Everybody taken together is burning 3 times the power of Bitcoin. Are they doing more work than 15 transactions a second? And unlike Bitcoin, data centers try to reduce power consumption. If I snap my finger and Amazon's data centers instantly use 1/10 the power, what's going to happen? My Amazon stock will go through the roof. They'll just use 1/10 less power and have a lot more profit. Bitcoin, well, they'll just eat it up. For reference, Tesla's $1.5 billion in Bitcoin was $1.5 billion investment in Destroy the Planet, Inc. That crazy billionaire doesn't care about the environment. Annual Bitcoin production of Bitcoin is on the order of 90 megatons. You could drive an F-150 Raptor for 120 billion miles to emit as much CO2 as Bitcoin does in a year. It's lunacy. Another problem, though, and this is one that you should understand, is the Sybil problem. So the cryptocurrency community loves to talk about the consensus problem. How do you agree on a view of history? Bitcoin's is simple, longest chain wins. But they aren't really talking about consensus. They're talking about the Sybil problem, the problem of spinning up fake nodes. So if you just had every node can sign something, well, some bad guy spins up a gazillion fake nodes. Proof of stake is an alternate solution to the Sybil problem. Basically, is he who has the gold rules. There's an easier solution to the Sybil problem. Identify the players. When you identify the named entities, like, say, in certificate authorities, you don't have Sybils anymore. Why don't cryptocurrencies do this? Well, first of all, a fair number of them lie and do this under the hood. All the efficient cryptocurrencies, for the most part, are lying and are relying on trusted entities. Or, if you do, though, you're a money transmitter and you're breaking the law, because there's actually pesky laws. But it gets even more fun. Here's a challenge to all those in the audience. Buy $1,500 worth of Bitcoin now, right now, without needing $1,500 cash in hand, transferring money to an individual, or having a pre-existing relationship with a Bitcoin exchange. You can't. Because everything in modern banking is reversible if it's electronic. It has an undo button. And the undo button is critical for mitigating fraud. They can go, oops, undo, 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 go back. But you can't in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is irreversible. So for seller of the Bitcoin must be doing either one of three things. They are either taking cash. Bitcoin ATMs don't take ATM cards. They take cash. Have an established relationship or extend so that they can extend the buyer credit, or take a deposit from a buyer and wait a couple of days. There's no other way to do it. In fact, this gentleman here, by the name of Steve Wozniak, tried to sell $70,000 worth of Bitcoin one day, threw it to a private party on PayPal, and only found out after he transferred the Bitcoin that it was a compromised PayPal account and the money got taken back. I think he can afford the $70,000 loss, but that's not a good system. And relatedly, this makes it very easy to steal. You compromise the private keys, you steal the Bitcoin. I've got a great paper on it, How to Make Money in Bitcoin in 10 Easy Steps. It's on the Buttcoin Foundation. But the result is you cannot store cryptocurrency on an internet-connected computer. If this is supposed to be the internet of money, you should be able to have it on your internet-connected computer, right? Wrong. You want to secure your system? Have a small Bitcoin wallet on it. When it gets stolen, you know you got compromised. I'm not joking. We actually detected a compromise this way in the early days, back in 2014. Where a student created a Bitcoin wallet that we monitored. We were deploying it on some systems to see if bad guys were starting to steal Bitcoin. And he had a copy in his Dropbox account, and his Dropbox account got compromised, the Bitcoin got stolen, and we knew about the compromise within a minute. Great, wonderful. But at the same time, you can't outsource. If you keep storing your Bitcoin on exchange, there's no insurance. There's no deposit insurance. So not your keys, not your Bitcoin. Talk about a security landmine. There's even more. So the primary tool these days that people are using is browser extensions like MetaMask. These are horribly opaque to use. So like a bunch of experts in non-fungible tokens were tricked by a phishing attack into having their MetaMask wallet sign basically a contract saying, I sell all my monkey JPEGs for $0. And the attacker just sat on that for a few weeks and then transferred all the monkey JPEGs from OpenSea to his wallet and then resold the monkey JPEGs on OpenSea and then took the money and ran. And if you're ever on Twitter, mention the word MetaMask. It's amusing the responses you get. There's this dream in the cryptocurrency space. Decentralization. Trust nobody. The entire system is trustworthy, but every actor is not. Now, first of all, this is one hell of a nihilistic worldview. But secondly, it doesn't work. Because this requires that there can never be a small group that can change things. And OK, the cryptocurrency community thinks it's a leap of faith, an article of faith, that such decentralization is a good idea. The only thing that buys is the crime, but it's a lie. The code is inevitably developed by one or a few groups. And a concrete example, in the early days of Ethereum, Ethereum has this mantra, code is law. Well, 10% of all Ethereum got invested in a buggy smart contract. Somebody came along, took all the Ethereum, and then what did the developers do? They go, you know that code is law, no central authority, no masters, bullshit? Yeah, it's bullshit. We're changing the code to steal the money back because it's our money you stole. The mining centralizes. So Bitcoin mining is really controlled by four or five entities. Four or five entities can rewrite history at will. And these miners are adversarial. So we've seen miners in Bitcoin land do adversarial games. We see miners in Ethereum do all sorts of adversarial games where, like, what they will do is go, oh, you want to trade this cryptocurrency? I'm going to do two trades right around yours in the block that make sure you get no money. And a lot of them aren't decentralized at all. They've got trusted coordinators or seed nodes, they've got ways of overriding or freezing assets. So they ain't decentralized. So what good is it? There's one thing cryptocurrency is good for, and that's censorship resistance. There's no central authority that says thou shalt not. Really, as we said, there actually are central authorities, but they don't care about your drug deals. If you believe there should be no central authorities, cryptocurrencies are the only solution. But this is crime. Drug dealing, money laundering, criminal payments, gambling, attempts to hire hitmen. The only economically productive use of cryptocurrency is crime. They're also really fun to steal. Ransomware and extortion. The current ransomware problem is on the order of tens of billions of dollars a year in damage. Billions with a B to the world economy. And it only exists because you can pay in cryptocurrency. There are some minor good uses, like you could do payments to WikiLeaks and Backpage. Oh, wait, Backpage was convicted of sexual trafficking? Yeah, okay, it's crime. Unless you need censorship resistance, they don't actually work as currency. Any volatile cryptocurrency transaction for the real world requires two currency conversion steps, dollars to Bitcoin, Bitcoins to dollars. Because that's the only way to avoid the volatility risk. Anybody know how much Bitcoin's down today? 10%, 15, 20, something like that. And so every now and then at the various Bitcoin waves, you'd get a fair number of companies go, hey, you can buy with Bitcoin. You could never actually buy with Bitcoin. They were using a service that turned Bitcoin into actual money. But if you believe in cryptocurrency, you must never sell the cryptocurrencies. The cryptocurrencies are designed to be deflationary. That is, they're worth more tomorrow than they are today. In a deflationary currency, rule number one is never spend your Bitcoin. Every year, the Bitcoin community celebrates Bitcoin Pizza Day. This was when some guy transfers some Bitcoin to somebody else who used his credit card to order a couple of pizzas. They've even celebrated by offering a pop-up shadow restaurant called Bitcoin Pizza,
which doesn't accept Bitcoin.
That Bitcoin now is worth pretty much your Breaking Bad cube of money, like tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so the result is the promise financial applications can never work in any volatile cryptocurrency. Period. End of story. Bitcoin and the like, for purchasing stuff, it's only good for buying drugs, paying ransoms, hiring fake hitmen, money laundering, etc. It does not work for real world. Never has and never will. Because otherwise, you use PayPal, Zelle, Zelle, M-Pasa, Square, etc. There's all these mechanisms that work so much better. And here's a test for you to give to anybody who goes, but Bitcoin in the third world, but cryptocurrency in the third world. Ask them what M-Pesa is. And they will go, because it's one of the most successful payment systems, started in Kenya about the same time as Bitcoin, and has been eating the third world. But censorship resistance is crime. Before the cyber crooks had Liberty Reserve, they got shut down. The only censorship resistance alternative is cash. Cash is heavy. $1 million in US dollar bills is a 10 kilogram hunk of stuff. A $100 bill may not weigh very much. 10,000 $100 bills starts to add up. And so the cryptocurrencies are the only game in town. So drug dealers started with Bitcoin in 2013. They hated it. They still hate it. It's the only thing that works. Ransomware used to be Green Dot and Bitcoin. Now it's Bitcoin only. Ransomware these days is a multi-billion dollar industry that exists solely because of Bitcoin as a payment channel. There is this notion of a stable coin that eliminate volatility. So in order to do a stable coin, what you need is an entity that would take dollars, turn them into crypto dollars, and vice versa. We know what these are. We've had them for hundreds of years. This is a bank, and these are a banknote. And first of all, this is a centralized entity, so why bother with a blockchain? Just keep the records in a database. But even assuming you do want a blockchain, well, all the other algorithmic stable coins, they're snake oil that have basically Ponzi schemes and stuff like that. But if you're a bank, you have a choice. You have one of three choices. You either become regulated as PayPal and Visa. You have a wildcat bank, so you issue unbanked banknotes. This is banking from the 1800s. Or you are like Liberty Reserve and end up in jail because there are obligations you have as a bank. The big stable coin called Tether is an absolute fraud. Bitcoin's value is a speculative bubble. Somebody in the future will pay more than you paid today. That's also why I call it a self-organizing Ponzi scheme. But there is a supply-demand. So our new Bitcoin coming in is matched by new dollars coming in and new fake dollars coming in. And throughout history of Bitcoin, there have been bubbles driven by fake money. So back in 2013, the first Bitcoin bubble was driven by a bot on the Magic the Gathering online exchange, Bitcoin exchange, that would create money out of thin air and buy Bitcoin, drive up the price. 2017, Tether first came on the scenes. Basically, one third of the price run-up in the 2017-2018 bubble was Tether. Now it's Tether and Circle. Basically, the real money in the system has been going out at a horrific rate. I actually thought it was going to collapse months ago because just the net inflow of fake dollars is so high compared with the net inflow of new cryptocurrency. And Tether printer go brr. Every cryptocurrency is me too with some features. They all basically the same idea, public ledger, state ledger, and a purported decentralized nature. Litecoin's my third favorite. It's Bitcoin with a catchy slogan. Litecoin silver to Bitcoin gold, first major altcoin. Dogecoin, Bitcoin with a cool joke. The founder of Dogecoin says, avoid the cryptocurrency space, burn it from the orbit, bury it in the desert, wear gloves. Ripple is securities fraud. IOTA was a centralized blockchain with trinary math and roll thy own crypto. Monero is Bitcoin with better privacy. Zcash is money laundering built in. Basically, Zcash allows you to deposit a coin into a mass anonymity pool and withdraw a coin with no way of linking which is which. So, money laundering. If you believe in financial privacy, this is financial privacy. If you believe in upholding the law, this is called money laundering. Ethereum is Bitcoin with unlicensed securities. There's also really weak security guarantees. Security is economics. They're proof of whatever, blah, blah, blah. Any lottery-based reward, however, creates mining pools. So five entities control Bitcoin. The code developers act as central authorities. And so this means that the guarantees from decentralization do not exist. But it gets even worse. So proof of work conceptually is economically unsound security. So the idea is the system wastes X dollars per hour in some sort of resources to defend against potential attackers. If the attacker needs to change the next N hours of history, they will need N times X. And that acts as a floor on how much the attacker has to spend. But that also acts as a ceiling. If the attacker doesn't really need to spend much more than $NX, so if the attacker can make more than that, supposed to be for hashing, that are really just about attacking any cryptocurrency you don't like, allow you to rewrite history with just a bit of money. So the security is either weak or inefficient. Proof of work is provably wasteful. There's no way to make it cheap. If you are willing to articulate the entities you trust, it is vastly cheaper. So let's take 10 trusted entities. Note that this is more meaningfully distributed than Bitcoin, where you're relying on less than 5. Each one has a Raspberry Pi that validates transactions. 6 need to be honest. This could easily process all the Bitcoin transactions without an issue. This would require 9 orders of magnitude less power than Bitcoin does. For the same level of real-world security, if you have to trust at least 5 entities. What the? Oh, and you can also have fun with self-propagating programs, because these cryptocurrencies are network things. We'll talk about worms later. But basically, compromise every node running a given cryptocurrency, and then steal all the other cryptocurrencies. So target Dogecoin. It's a fork of Lucky Coin, fork of Litecoin, fork of Bitcoin. Find a remote code execution vulnerability in Dogecoin, make it spread to all other Dogecoin nodes, and then steal every cryptocurrency on those systems. Oh, and it's written in C++. Don't actually do it, but it's a fun thought exercise. But wait, what about the venture money? Isn't there a ton of venture money in the cryptocurrency space right now? Yes, there is, because securities fraud as their business model. So the old venture capital model is you invest in several companies. One or two end up thriving, and those you either sell to the public or sell to another company. The A16Z models these days, though, is security fraud as a business. You invest in several blockchain startups. Each startup issues their own tokens, promising something eventually. These tokens are really unlicensed securities. It's blatantly illegal, but not currently enforced. A16 gets a ton of these tokens. They sell the tokens they get to retail suckers, getting the cash out they would get in an IPO before the company is able to do anything. And okay, it's grossly illegal, but let's assume the SEC actually wakes up and enforces the bloody law. Well, the startups were the ones issuing the unlicensed securities. A16Z was just buying them. What that company does, it's not my concern. So why there's so much venture money in the blockchain space right now is because the venture capitalists have figured out securities fraud as their business model. What about non-currency blockchain applications? Well, let's put a bird on it. Private or permission blockchains, as I said, we've known how to do that for 20 plus years. The only value you get in saying blockchain is idiots throw money at you. Public blockchains can't work. They're the cryptocurrencies. And in general, anybody proposes a blockchain solution to something doesn't actually understand the problem. Solve voting, electronic medical records, by putting what data, what formats, what honesty, what enforcement, how do you know the data is right, in an append-only data structure. How you store the data is not the problem. Let's go with a concrete example. This is from my experience. This is why I have my iron law. A couple years ago, there was a blockchain class at Berkeley. I screamed internally. There was another one last semester. I screamed internally again. That first one, I attended one session to give a short rebuttal. There were two outside experts, though, who presented before me about the revolution that blockchain was going to present. This was an actual example. Vaccine supply chains. This was an example back from 2018, but it's still pretty good today. That in order to transfer vaccines, you need to keep the supply chain suitably cold. It's called a cold chain. If it gets too hot, the vaccine is ruined. One expert was, you could solve this problem in India with blockchains. And said it honestly with a straight face and actually believed that. Now, I'm going, no. The problem is sensing. How do you know if the vaccine has gotten over temperature? The problem is data inclusion. Who includes the data? The problem is you don't need to because you just use a $1.50 ShockWatch label. You stick one of these labels on and it changes color if it ever goes out of temperature spec. And this is why I have my iron law of blockchain. Blockchain solves exactly one problem. When someone says you can solve X with blockchain, they clearly don't know anything about X and you should just ignore them. It's a great filter. That is the one problem blockchain solves. There is one innovative new stupidity in this space though, smart contracts. I love smart contracts. I love smart contracts for the comedy gold. The idea is, hey, contracts are expensive. So let's take standard contracts that are written in a formal language called legalese. It looks vaguely like English. It's not, but it's similar. And let's replace them with things written in a horrid language that looks vaguely like JavaScript, where in general we can't update. First of all, how's that going to make things cheaper? Standard contracts. The whole point of a standard contract is it doesn't cost anything to draft a standard contract. And then we ditch the exception handling mechanism. If I can steal from a smart contract and it says yes, am I violating the contract? Oh, and backstory. The reason why these things were created in the first place was Vitalik Buterin was upset that World of Warcraft nuked his spellcaster, or nerfed his spellcaster, and wanted inviolable, immutable code so that they could never nerf me again. I'm not kidding, actually. That was his reason. But that's not what they really are. What they really are is finance bots, small programs that work on money. Now, we have had finance bots for decades. The difference is the finance bots we've had for decades are not public. You don't interact with them directly, and they're running on reversible fabrics. So if something goes wrong, they can press an undo button. When you go off into the real world and have a 401k, invest in index funds. It means hand your money off to a finance bot that happily invests in the broad stock market, and there's plenty of math saying that's the optimal finance bot. So finance bots are an old idea. Smart contracts are, hey, let's make the finance bots run publicly so Joe Rando can directly interact with the code, and run it on an irreversible pattern fabric, so if the code screws up, there's no undo button. So your code has to be perfect. Anybody else think this is a stupid idea? It's great for comedy gold, because the result is a smart contract, as David Gerard puts it, is really a pinata for black hats to whack on until the money spills out. Right from the start, they've been million-dollar bug bounties. The first major smart contract, the Dow, was a voting mutual fund as a smart contract. It got 10% of all Ethereum invested in it before somebody stole all the money due to a bug in the contract. And then the Ethereum developers go, code is law, ha, ha, ha. We're changing the code of the underlying cryptocurrency to undo the theft. Who's the real theft? The guy who followed the code, or the guys who changed the code to steal the money back? You'd think that would have stopped smart contracts as an idea. Nope. The parity multi-signature wallet. The idea is cryptocurrencies are hard to do, so let's make multi-party checks. So rather than one signature, you have to have three signatures. Good idea, except that there was a bug. The bug basically allowed somebody to go up to the wallet, go, hey, cryptocurrency wallet, you belong to me now. Hey, cryptocurrency wallet, give me all your money. And this resulted in millions of dollars of cryptocurrency stolen. It wasn't as big a disaster as it could have been, because a white hat saw this happening, did his own theft, and then took the stolen money and handed it back to the victims. Then a subsequent bug on the updated version. Somebody went up to the master contract that all the wallets depended on. Hey, master contract, you belong to me now. Hey, master contract, just kill yourself. And so the master contract killed itself, and tens of millions of dollars worth of Ethereum are now locked up forever, immutable. Oh, and the primary developer behind this is the guy who invented the bleeping programming language for the smart contracts in the first place. What? My favorite is the proof of weak hands explicit Ponzi scheme. There have been a lot of Ponzi schemes of smart contracts. You now have these decentralized autonomous organizations. Let's get together, create an organization where we all invest, we all get a vote. This is a centuries-old idea. It's called a joint stock corporation. Now, a joint stock corporation has a fair bit of real legal world paperwork because it gives liability protection. DAOs do not. DAOs are more of a general partnership, or, as I like to put it, a conspiracy. Basically, every DAO governance contract sold on a blockchain is an unlicensed security, and they're breaking security law, so conspiracy. The rest of the space is just literally speedrunning half a millennia of financial failures. So almost every cryptocurrency is full of frauds and wash trades that were banned in the 1930s. We've got Ponzi schemes, more Ponzi schemes, fair Ponzi schemes, explicit Ponzi schemes. The best still had to be in the early days of Bitcoin, where 10% of all Bitcoin was invested into a single Ponzi scheme run by an anonymous guy. Guess what his online handle was? Pirate at 40. Do you trust Pirate at 40? Well, if you do, you can either invest directly in his Ponzi scheme, or if you aren't the lucky, there's always the pirate pass-through funds. Tether is a wildcat bank. It literally is 18th century or 19th century banking. Every tradable ICO, every tradable governance token is an unregulated security. These were a plague in the 1720s. The stock touts are a plague in the 1720s, and we still get them today. You see them all over Twitter hyping the latest thing. We have fun things let's go back. Oops, problem with animated slides. No fine grade. But so many of the frauds are blatant. So like this is one from a few years back. I had a choice. Did I want to talk about the AIDS cure but with blockchain ICO, or the alchemy on the blockchain ICO? I went with alchemy. We basically have tulip mania. So the NFT mania is actually NFT mania 2.0. Back in 2017, these little ugly creatures killed Ethereum from too much demand, and they were literally a bubble. The tulip mania lasted like a couple of weeks. This one's lasting longer, but like the reason that fine fellow sold for $110,000 was the seller thought they could then sell it for $150,000. Classic tulip mania. And also there's a lot of gold bugism in the cryptocurrency space. The gold bug hard money stuff, and that's just economic lunacy. You want to make an economic professor cry, talk about the gold standard. And then, of course, my cat has thoughts about this. Smart contracts and the decentralized finance crowd are speedrunning the speedrun all over again while huffing crystal meth. The idea is, hey, only Wall Street had previously benefited from these super widow tech bang innovation thingies like, oh, say, credit default swaps, mortgage-backed securities, and all those other lovely things. So let's build all of that as smart contracts instead. The only applications end up being fraudulent stocks, tulip manias. The non-fungible tokens are literally a receipt for a URL saying you own this monkey JPEG. Implicit Ponzi schemes, these yield farming schemes are implicit or self-organizing Ponzi schemes. You've got a lot of explicit Ponzi schemes. You've got front-running bots and fraudulent miners. So if you want to buy on one of these decentralized finance systems, and there's potential for the miner to trade to sandwich you, they will. They will basically construct the blocks so that you want to buy X, they buy X, drive up price, you buy X, they sell X, they pocket the difference. There's a name for this. It's called minor extractable value. $1 million thefts seem to happen on a near daily basis, unless it's $10 million, don't get me out of bed. Frauds happen on a near daily basis. If you want the amusement saga of what's currently going on, check out the website. Web3 is going just great. It's a beautiful catalog of all these issues. There's a recent rebranding. How many have heard of the Web3? The cryptocurrency is going to take over. Let's bring the unstoppable, sensor-resistant blockchain power to the web. Now, the current web is decentralized. There's a lot of entities, but they're named entities, and you have to contract with a couple. You have to contract with a DNS provider, and you have to contract with a web hosting provider. And so you have this nice little model where the user's browser is running half the computation, your stuff is running the computation on the web server, you've got yourself a database, it stores the data, it's all good. And yes, there's sensors. If you want to do something that is totally reviled by everybody, like, oh, say, child exploitation material, nobody will host you. But you can be a literal Nazi, and you can find companies to host you. Russia's good, Ukraine's good, just basically anywhere but Germany. Hint, though, to Nazis, don't say that, hey, this says Cloudflare likes us. Cloudflare gets mad. So we have sensors in the current system, but you get to choose your sensor. It isn't just an arbitrary government. It's specific environment. You can arbitrage your choice. So if you want something that pisses off China, like the grand tribute to Winnie the Pooh, host in the US. If you want something that pisses off the US, well, Ecuadorian embassy, Russia, etc. And this is what the current web looks like. I'm going to show you the Web3 vision. This is by not a doubter, by the way. This is the Web3 vision as encapsulated by a supposed evangelist. This is not a parody. We still have our front end, so we have not removed our gatekeepers. Instead, what we've done is we've added a little bit of the computation is instead paid for in cryptocurrency by an extension in the user's browser. So the user's browser now has a signing function to sign away cryptocurrency. We have back-end, the Ethereum virtual machine. We've got centralized providers to make interfacing with that Ethereal virtual machine usable. We've got centralized providers to allow us to deal with the data. We've got centralized providers to provide scaling. And we have a distributed storage architecture that actually is really just BitTorrent on steroids, so you still need seeders anyway. So you still have data providers. How many gatekeepers have we removed from this? None. How many gatekeepers have we added? A hell of a lot. But you could argue this is useful because, hey, we now have the unstoppable power of the Ethereum virtual machine to protect our distributed apps. Let's actually go through the math. The Ethereum virtual machine is an ugly little stack machine, and it runs on gas. Every instruction has a fixed amount of gas that it consumes. And as a result, the simplest computation is 3 gas, 256-bit addition, 2 million gas per second. So we can do 600,000 additions per second on the Ethereum blockchain. Globally, worldwide, total. All of Ethereum, burning as much power as a major country, can do 600,000 ads a second. because all the miners are doing the same computation. Cost to use, $250 a second. My favorite little Raspberry Pi, 3 billion additions per second, and it cost me $45 to buy forever. The Ethereum world computer is 1/5,000th as powerful as a $40 Raspberry Pi. What the? Basically, the space is dismal. The value is non-existent. That's why I say this lecture, apart from hash chains, Merkle trees, and Sybils, is about immunizing you against crap. Because this is a virus. Its harms are substantial. It's enabled billion-dollar criminal enterprises. It's enabled venture capitalists to do securities fraud as their business. And it's sucked in people. And so basically do one of two things. Either avoid it or help me make it die in a fire. Because I don't want to ever have to give this talk ever again. Because I want this space to die. And the final time, I thought the previous bubble pop would have done it, but it didn't. But I think this one will, because there's just so much collateral damage. Oh, and F Matt Damon.